CataractCoach.com podcast series episode number 154 with Dr. Edgar Espana, explaining corneal scarring, collagen stiffness, incision architecture, and everything else you want to know about the cornea. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today I've got a very special guest, someone who's very brilliant about bridging clinical activities like surgery and what patients you see in the clinic, but also the research that you do in a lab. And this is all about the corneas. This is Dr. Edgar Espana from the University of South Florida in Tampa. Thank you, my friend. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you for having me.
For sure. Now, interestingly, you have a very different global perspective on training, because you obviously did all your ophthalmology training initially first in Colombia, but then you've also done a glaucoma fellowship in the U.S., you've done a research fellowship at Bascom Palmer, you've done a cornea fellowship at the Cola Institute. You've got a lot of various experiences behind you.
Well, I when I started working in ophthalmology, doing my residency in Colombia, I spent a lot of time in the eye band. And my hospital used to have, I don't remember, it was the only or the second biggest eye bank in Bogota. And we spent a lot of time there looking at those corneas and harvesting tissue and everything. And then I started developing just like a taste for something a little bit different from just surgery. And it was nice to collect those cells. And then we look at the spectral microscopies. And then I started working on amniotic membrane. We were collecting amniotic membranes from the hospital. We were to the OBGYN floor. And some patient delivered a baby. And then we stole the placentas and we ran down. And I started working on that. I started developing that appreciation for research in Colombia. But in Colombia, I mean, it's very hard to do basic research. There's no resources, and it's almost impossible. So I contacted Schaefer Sen, who worked in amniotic membrane years ago, and I emailed him and said, "Hey, I'm really interested in amniotic membrane and limbal stem cells and that stuff." And he emailed me like 2 minutes later, said, "If you want to come, please come." And for some of you that may know, from Bogota to Miami is like 3 hours flight. It's just pretty easy, pretty quick. So I just came and I started working on that. And I really enjoy it. And every month after month, I started developing more and more passion for research. And it has been it's a different perspective. I mean, these guys or people that mentor me, they have like a different perspective of ophthalmology and clinical work. And, you know, you see a patient, but you're not only looking at the cornea and the sutures and the astigmatism, but you're also looking like at the keratocytes and the nerves. I don't know. It's a different perspective. And that's what I like the most.
Yeah. What's amazing is that you have such a varied experience. You took the best of what you learned in Colombia, the best of what you learned in the Schaefer Singh, the best of what you learned in your fellowship at so many different institutions, and you kind of bring all that together. So it gives you a different perspective. Like, I may not have great perspective because I did all my training only in Los Angeles.
Well, when I was in Colombia again, I worked at the iBank, and I met in my residency program, it was a fantastic program because the training was exceptional. My first day I took call for ophthalmology, my senior told me, "Hey, let's go downstairs to the emergency room, see what's going on." And this is the biggest public hospital in Bogota, Colombia, in a very hot zone in the 90s. And very dangerous there. So I went downstairs to the emergency room, and there was people dying on the floors. There were students putting chest tubes. And it was like, oh my God, this is just unexpected. And that's kind of the hospital where I trained at the beginning, and residents were supposed to do everything. So you have an emergency case, so you have cases. The senior was the teaching you, and the first year was doing the case pretty much. The attendants were available most of the time, but sometimes if you have a complication, you had to resolve everything. So it was a nice experience to be a surgeon. You become used to bad cases and not to having all the instruments and not to having the best equipment and that stuff. But there was no research, so it's different. And then I have been here. I was here in big institutions here where you have all this equipment, these people that's very experienced, very dedicated. I mean, it's very nice to see how things have changed too. But it's different. I don't know how to explain it to you, but it's nice to have that in your head. So when you're doing some difficult case or some weird case, you know that you could do it with less equipment and less instruments. So you relax, take a deep breath and say, "Well, let me think, we can do this or we can do that." You still remember those times.
Right. It's a very, you learned by doing, especially in the early years of residency. You kept your hands doing, you were working all the time. And as you said, sometimes you don't even have the full resources, you don't have the full instruments, you just have to figure it out.
You have to figure it out, and that's a nice thing of being trained in a third world country, pretty much not all the resources. Although there's places that I have all of them. My institution at that time is a public university, so we didn't have all the resources. Or either we had it, but they were not available at night. If there were some cases we had to go at night or something like that, we always had to try to, do the best we could, and that was important because create some somehow there's some innovation there for you to
Right.
develop your own instruments, to your own techniques, little things like that.
Well, I think it's very helpful now because you supervise and train residents and fellows there in Tampa, and Tampa General Hospital, TGH. Wow, that's a busy place. You see
That's
a
a
lot
busy
of
place.
things.
That's a busy place. It's a huge place, level one hospital. So it's very busy, and there's a lot of trauma. There's a lot of, we do a lot of complex cases. And also, we do a lot of patients that cannot go, and it's, they cannot go, they cannot get MAC clearance, so they cannot get anesthesia in a surgery center. So all those bad cataracts in patients that are very sick, they come to this place, and it is sometimes it's challenging, not only because the cataract itself is difficult, it's because also the medical condition makes it very difficult. Those patients that have neck issues or they have COPD, so they have to be kind of, they cannot lay flat, they cannot go to sleep. All these things can be challenging sometimes.
Right. Now, when you're teaching residents, I've heard you talk about your reverse order approach. So instead of having a resident who's brand new, just starting, don't have them make the incision for the surgery. Because if they make a bad incision, the whole surgery's a mess. Better to have them start at the back end, maybe just at the end of the case, remove viscoelastic.
Yeah, so I think it's easier. You know, people know that if you have a bad incision, that you're done pretty much, or a bad rexis. So, but if you come, they start learning how to seal the wound, then how to remove viscoelastic, then how to put the IUL, you go backwards. So I think that has been very helpful, and residents and fellows appreciate that. I was doing more resident training in my first years, and in the last 5, 6 years, the residents are with me for the cornea cases, but the fellows are with me. They do, let's say we do 50-50 in cataracts with the residents and with the fellows. The residents it's been less these days, but I still have residents with me in during surgery days.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So one thing I would always have the residents do is just start with suturing. Suturing 10-0 nylon on a corneal incision. It sounds easy, but when you're a beginning resident, it's not easy.
Well, that's another advantage of you know my chairman too. He also trained in India, so we are good suturing. We because in third world countries we suture, and then PKPs you got a suture, or dogs or whatever it is you had a suture. But these days residents don't suture unless they do open gloves at night or trauma cases that you need to put a lot of stitches. Usually, phaco you put one stitch, or in trabeculectomies or tube shunts, 10-0 nylon they put two or three stitches. It's not much, so yeah, it's challenging. And because we do cases at night, sometimes we want the residents to be very efficient. You don't want a resident learning how to do an open glove, learn how to suture at 3 in the morning. So yes, we always try to let them learn during the day.
Yeah, one of my advice for the residents when I was teaching residents was, can you do what I called cataract coach 10, 10, 10? Can you do 10 sutures of 10 or nylon in 10 minutes in the wet lab? And it's not as easy as people think.
No. I know. We yes, everything is tricky at the beginning. At least everything is tricky, and the eye or anterior segment surgery, you gotta be so delicate with the movement, with everything. So at the beginning, it takes time, and it's challenging. And I have a couple. I mean, I would say I have chest pain at least 4 times a month with the residents or fellows.
Yes, it can be a very stressful thing to do for sure. Now, let's talk just specifically about throwing a 10-0 nylon suture in the cornea. Now, how do you determine the correct depth, and how do you determine the correct tension to put to close the incision?
Well, I usually when I do PKPs or dogs or anterior lamellas, whatever, I try to go around 80 to 90% deep, and then the tension, I lock the stitch, the suture. So when you lock, you can control the tension. I don't use with it, and then on the yes, I lock the first knot pretty much, then. that's how I control the tension. But I was told to go 80 to 90% depth in this stromal depth. Because if you go full thickness, pretty much you're creating a track to the anterior chamber. So that's too dangerous. And if you go too shallow, I don't think the opposition of the tissue is that good. So 80%, 90%, that's how we go. And sometimes depending in those dulks that there's like more tissue in the recipient, you got to bring it down. So you got to kind of play around with how deep you go on one side and on the other side to try to bring the graft under the recipient so the epithelial cells can go on top of it. Because for epithelial cells, it's hard to go above. They can go under, but it's hard to go on top. They cannot go up.
Right. So I talked to someone else who was explaining to me his approach for a corneal laceration. So traumatic corneal laceration is to suture it at 100% depth, because therefore then he's sure that the layers of the cornea will line up perfectly. There'll be no step, which is different than what I was taught. I was taught like you, 80, 90% depth. But he says that may cause a step effect at the corneal laceration.
I would be worried about what I'm telling you, that you create a track.
Communication
to the AC, and then you can have a bacteria going straight. I mean, you got one of those sutures get infected. It goes directly into the anterior chamber.
So, right.
But wound healing, that's what I work on. My research is pretty much stromal wound healing and collagens and that stuff. I will tell you, I think I've been working on that for many years. It's pretty much unpredictable. Who knows how they are going to heal? I was like, it's impossible to know. Some people, you put some bad stitches, they heal beautifully. And some people, you don't, and they don't heal nicely. I mean, it's impossible to predict what's going to happen in there.
Now, you've done a lot of work in the cornea and kind of trying to modulate or minimize corneal scarring and corneal haze.
So I when I came to the U.S., I worked with Schaefer Sen and stem cells at the limbus epithelium, and I spent a lot of time on that, and then I'm using membrane to improve wound healing. But if you go to you work in my hospital or any place you work, other places I've been, it's very uncommon to have bilateral chemical burns or things like that. They exist. They are a disaster. We feel bad for these patients, but that's not very, very common. But it's scars. Everybody gets scarred. You have herpes, you have shingles, you got trauma, you got a burn, whatever you get a stromal scar. So I focus my research mostly on stromal scars. And that's the main indication for penetrating keratoplasty or lamellar keratoplasty. So I think doing PKPs or doing lamellar grafts is nice. It's an art. That's how we made our living. We make our livings. But I don't think that's the future. I think the future is to modulate that the scar formation, modulate wound healing. While the scar is forming, you can manipulate the scar. So instead of having a thick scar, you have a mild scar that you later on you just put a hard contact lens and you still can see decently. Not 20/20, but you still can get a nice 20/30, 20/40. That's what I've been working on mostly, trying to modulate how severe the scars become, or how they to modulate the formation of scars, to ameliorate the formation of scars.
Is there something we can modulate? Can we modulate the TGF beta? Is there something to we can intervene?
So there's many, many ways you could modulate. And that's what we do these days. Like with PRK, you pretty much are modulating scar tissue by killing the fibroblasts or the myofibroblasts or keratinocytes with mitomycin C. That's pretty much what PRK does when you use mitomycin C. My work is we let the corneals, we create lacerations or abrasions in mice, stromal abrasions, and then these are all transgenic mice. And when the scars start forming, we start manipulating either TGF beta or collagens. So the cells, after an injury, they start depositing a lot of collagens, because that's normal. That's a normal defense mechanism. You have a laceration to prevent an infection or to prevent the intraocular contents to come out of the eye. What the body does is just try to close a wound as quick as possible, throw in a lot of collagens. So what we do is decrease the amount of collagens or manipulate those collagens, because collagens are a very complex thing, and we think about collagen like one thing, but it's like 20 something collagens.
Right.
So my work is in specific collagens, trying to decrease the synthesis of those some of those collagens while the wound is healing. But it's kind of working. But you know, people always expect, hey, when are you gonna find a cure for scars? Well, I don't know. We keep working. I mean, we can make it better sometimes in mice, but that's different from just having a drop or some type of gene therapy that will just disappear scars that are already formed.
So one day will we get to the special drop that we can place after corneal injury that'll prevent the scarring or really minimize the scarring?
I think that there's two. When we talk about scars, I think there's two ways to work on them. One is to prevent when it's forming. So somebody has a bacterial ulcer. You wait for the epithelium to close, and when the scar is forming, you can do something chemical therapy. I mean, some chemical gene therapy. You can do something in there, and that's one thing to do. I think that's the easiest way to do it, because you still can control something that is forming, because the cells are depositing collagen like putting bricks and concrete in there. So you kind of stop them, say, don't do that much. You're doing too much. That's one way. The other way, which I think is almost impossible. I don't think it's possible, but whatever. Some people think it's possible. Once you have a big, thick scar, to do something, like they are injecting keratinocytes or stem cells or stromal stem cells or mesenchymal stem cells, they inject it in there, and they think this is going to clear up, dissolve the scar and synthesize new collagen in an organized fashion. I don't think it's possible, but some people work in that. Because the one of the reasons I'm an ophthalmologist, and I was telling you about the eye bank, is the first time I saw the cornea, and say, how is that possible that you can have a tissue that is so clear and transparent? I mean, and if you look at books from from history or whatever, everybody's looking through the soul of your soul through your cornea, pretty much.
Right.
Such a fantastic tissue. Is the vitreous and the cornea the only tissues in the body that are avascular and clear? You know, that's the only two tissues in your body that are avascular and clear, the vitreous and the cornea. So everything is challenging, I would say, to make it clear again. It's the arrangement of the cells when the cornea is forming, all these keratinocytes that migrate in and deposit the collagen, so organized. And we see those little collagen fibrils in the books. They're all perpendicular and perfectly aligned. I don't think you can replicate that after you have an injury, because that's God's work. I don't think it's possible. That's nature's work. It's very hard to replicate.
Right. Now, do you think there'll ever be some other treatment? Like right now, when I do PRK, I'll use dilute mitomycin to help prevent haze or scarring. But is there something else we should do?
No, I think there will be more treatment, but mitomycin, I think, for example, cross-linking is killing also or delaying those keratinocytes from replicating. But I don't know if you have seen, we have seen some cases of bacterial infections or herpes recurrence after cross-linking.
Right.
Where you have killed those first, the UV light's going to destroy or kill or create apoptosis of a lot of those keratinocytes. And if you get an infection on top of that, those are a disaster. You don't have cells to make collagen, to help with the healing, because keratinocytes, they probably also call the immune system to come in and say, there's an infection, come and help us, and they make collagen and stuff. But if you have mitomycin or UV light creating apoptosis, you're pretty much damaging the defense of the eye. So if an infection happens or something happens, it's a big problem too. So when you manipulate normal healing, also can become a very big problem.
Are there other compounds or drugs we could use to do cross-linking instead of riboflavin and UV light? Is there something else that we could do? Is there another potential compound?
There's we published a couple of papers recently. There's something called Genipin. Genipin is a chemical the other thing is cross-linking. You know, we know the tissue gets stiffer, but I don't know if people knows exactly. I don't think anybody knows exactly how cross-linking occurs. But this Genipin drop is a cross-linking medication. It comes from papayas or something like that. And we use it to cross-link tissues, not for keratoconus, but to stop melting after a bacterial infection. When you're having an infection and you see the cornea is melting, your wall is going to perforate. I have a study with Dr. Avila in Bogota, and he put it in, I think we had seven patients or something like that, where he put this compound on the cornea. and slow down the melting because the cornea got stiffer. So that way, it's harder for these collagenase and metalloproteinases to destroy the collagen, because now the tissue is stiffer, so it's harder to break. And it helps or prevent it, or it slow down at least perforation. It doesn't kill the bacteria, but it helps you from getting a PKP at night.
Yeah, I had not heard of the medicine. I had to look it up. It's my audience. It's Genipin.
Genipin. There's papers on that. And it's not only used for the eye. I think they have used it in tendons and other stuff. And there has been some research where they injected, I haven't looked at this in the last year, but there's a couple people in, I think in Georgia Tech or something, they were injecting in subtenon to prevent myopia and stuff like that in some myopia model, because it cross-links the collagen in the sclera, so the eye doesn't get longer and longer.
Wow, interesting. Maybe we could use it even just to modulate the corneal curvature.
Once the cornea is formed, I don't know, but it will make the cornea stiffer, that's for sure. And you just put it in there and you can see how it makes it stiff. You can feel it. You just can feel it.
Well, you mean this is fantastic. Well, like today, our approach, if I have a patient who's -3 of myopia and their cornea is 45 diopters, our approach is I'll use an excimer laser or femtosecond laser and I'll take away corneal tissue to make their new curvature 42 diopters. But the question is, could I leave all their tissue alone and instead don't take any tissue away, just change the shape of the existing tissue?
Well, I don't know, this is published. This is, and I know it's not a randomized prospective study, whatever, but there's people saying that use oral riboflavin, and they have some, I have seen some data where people says, well, you have your, I don't know what dose of riboflavin for 3 months, and then they come back and they repeat the pentacams and or the topographies or whatever, and there's flattening of the cornea. So without any UV light or anything, I mean, just sunlight UV light. Maybe. And also it's interesting, some research we're currently doing where we work in a lot of mouse, my work is in mouse models of keratoconus or mouse models. We just published a paper where we can create keratoconus in a mouse, for example. But also we have a mouse model of Ehlers-Danlos disease. And Ehlers-Danlos disease, they don't make the right amount of collagen 5. Okay. So they only have 50% of collagen 5, and that way their corneas are very thin. However, they are very stiff. That's why, you know, I think there was a contraindication for LASIK for FDA, Ehlers-Danlos disease, but a lot of people have Ehlers-Danlos that is, it hasn't been diagnosed, and then, you know, you don't see ectasias in them. It's because, all these collagens and all this cross-linking is weird, and we don't know much about it. But these patients, they have a very thin cornea, but it's stiff, and they don't have more keratoconus. And one of the reasons we're working now is because maybe the cells and the keratocytes in that stroma, they have a lot of senescence. There's a lot of senescence in those cells. So the collagens they make at when patients are younger, in the mid-teens or something, they get so activated because there's not enough collagen, or they don't have enough stiffness in the matrix and in the stromal matrix, that they get so activated they make so much collagen when they are younger, when the patients are in the mid-teens. When they become adults, they have made so much collagen that cornea becomes stiff already.
Wow.
And that's why they never develop any ectasias or any problems like that. But those cells are not good, and then they don't. They got scars and other stuff, but it's this nature always trying to compensate to make us function.
So with all the different types of collagens, they're all like various building blocks. And so you can try to modulate how much of collagen 5 versus collagen 12 and get a different result.
Yes, I think that's and also, for example, TGF-beta, collagen 12, somehow regulates TGF-beta, collagen 5 regulates TGF-beta, and at the same time TGF-beta regulates those collagens. It's so complex and so complicated, but I think prevention of scar formation is going to be the future. Now there's some people is using I forgot the name of Steve Wilson's eye drops. They use this for scars too. some forgot the name of the medication they use, but they are using some medications when the scars are there with to inhibit myofibroblasts from contracting, right. Survival. So there are going to be more and more things coming because scars is a big problem. I mean, for cornea, for us, what is a bigger problem than a scar? I don't know. I don't think. I don't know, neurotrophic or dry. Well, dry eye is very common, but you don't lose vision of that unless it's very severe. Right. Scars is a big problem for everybody. Not only in the eye, the scar tissue and fibrosis is a problem for living. You can get idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis and die, liver fibrosis, everything. Scar formation and fibrosis is a big deal. For glaucoma surgery is a problem. For epiretinal membrane is a problem. So scar is very, very, very important.
Right. If we can learn how to modulate the scarring response in the eye, even rest of the body, that's a huge benefit.
That's it. But the cornea gives you an advantage. You can see, you can create a medication. You can do something for pulmonary fibrosis, but you cannot see anything. You don't know what's going on. You got to do spirometry. You got to whatever. In the eye, you can see it live. And if you have those nice mice that you can put on the microscope and the cells are green and red, you can see everything day after day how scars are forming and stuff like that. So the cornea has that advantage too. So is pretty beautiful.
Yeah, that's the big advantage. Did you ever think back in 1990 when you started medical school that you spend your whole career focusing on 500 microns of tissue?
That's what I tell my wife all the time. I don't understand how this happened, but that's what happened. My father was a urologist. My dream was to be a urologist. And one day I tried to get into residency in urology in South America. I couldn't get in. And then I got into ophthalmology and I never looked back. And I really like what I do. I think cornea is, again, it's clear, it's avascular, and yes. Also has a lot of immune properties. So that thing is just a fantastic tissue. I just like it. I don't know why. It's just a nice piece of tissue.
I think it's much better than urology, for sure. Now, we're talking about the cornea too. You also did some work about endothelial regeneration. You've got slow cycling cells. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so I was looking around. Finally, I set up. I mean, I've been working more now in the stroma, scar, and that stuff. But yes, and there was a time before, what's the name? DSWO or DA, whatever, when you remove the decimate, but you don't replace endothelium. And there were some papers that people that started demos. Some papers came saying that there's an option. You know, animals. Some animals, the endothelium replicates, and you do, you scratch the endothelium in a mouse, in a rabbit, they replicate. They come back. They can form a new endothelium. They replicate. New endothelial cells will form. They don't get larger. They just replicate and replenish. But that I know, humans, monkeys, and cats, they don't. The endothelium doesn't replicate. So I work a lot on that. Not a lot. I work some on that. I've been always fascinated by the endothelium. And one of the things we did is we inject some kind of stem cell marker into the blood of mice, and then we create some injuries and start looking. And we did not expect to have those markers in the periphery of the endothelium. So we found that the peripheral endothelium has some markers for progenitor cells and stem cells. So they are not supposed to have it because they're supposed not to replicate, but there's some in there. And I think in the future what there are people going to find is those endothelial mark, I mean those progenitor cells at the periphery of the endothelium probably are not good only for replication into the cornea but also into the trabecular meshwork. So probably those cells go both ways. They go into the cornea or they go to replenish the endothelial cells of the meshwork. One time I was thinking with somebody who were thinking that when you do SLT, you know, nobody knows how SLT works. Maybe you're just killing the old cells and allowing a space for new progenitor cells from that area to just go back and replenish, repopulate, and bring new function in there. It has to be something. The stem cells are there in the periphery of the cornea endothelium.
So if we have a patient now where I've also seen when someone does DSO, decimate stripping only, so they just take off the central decimate layer, and by some magic, those progenitor cells replenish the endothelium in that one area where they were stripped off. So is there a way we can wake up those cells so we don't even have to do that part? Wake up the cells to replenish and endothelialize that layer.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's very difficult, and also you gotta think that one thing is to have Fuchs, and a different business is having a bullous keratopathy, because Fuchs, I think you remove the gutta, which pretty much is a lot of collagen. Extracellular matrix, collagen and other things. You remove that so you can see fine. You're removing the obstruction of the gutta, but the rest of the endothelium is functionally normal. So it will slide in, maybe a little bit replicates in the periphery, maybe I don't know, but then it will slide in and create a new basement membrane, and you will have a new membrane on the stroma, so it will work. But in bullous keratopathy or like TAS or something like that, that's a different business, because everything is damaged all over, all the way to the meshwork. So for those are more difficult. But Fuchs, I think, is just easier because you are creating a significantly, I don't know if it's small or big, but you an injury that you can replenish just by sliding in, or maybe a little replication. For Fuchs, maybe. I think that's already done, and I think that's going to get better and better. There will be some pathway. One of the problems is to get that medication inside the eye too. I don't think if those medications we use as eye drops are penetrating that easily. And if it penetrates, I don't know how long they last. You know, if that drop, it goes there for a few hours and then disappears. Right. But I'm sure there's going to be some medication that stimulates proliferation of those cells somehow. And for Fuchs, it will work. I don't know for bullous. Bullous is different because everything is damaged.
Right. No, it's interesting. Yeah, you just can't, the eye drop won't penetrate well. If you inject into the anterior chamber, the problem is the AC turns over too fast. It won't last more than a couple hours. So maybe you'll have to inject it subcon, subtenon, something to help keep it around. I don't know.
That's one of the problems of the cornea, that we are so well protected by the epithelium to prevent infections that nothing penetrates there easily.
Right. Now, in terms of surgical corneal disease, we've seen a lot of change over the last 10, 20 years. When you and I did our training 30 years ago, it was all penetrating keratoplasty. That was the only option, penetrating keratoplasty. Then we started moving now to more lamellar treatments. And we went from, let's for the end of the end, we went to from DSEC to now to DMEC. Are we soon going to go towards injection of just the endothelial cells directly?
I think so. I'm not working on that much, but I think that's already, I think Dr. Kinoshita, I think is the name. He used to work on that. I think somebody in California, in Stanford or something, is working on that. They culture the endothelial cells, and then with some magnets or something, they attach it. They put a contact lens that's metallic. Mm. And they attach some magnetic beads to the endothelial cells that they inject into the interior chamber. And then you got to be face down, so they attach to the back of your cornea. So I think people is working on that. The problem with endothelial cells is they replicate, but they have a tendency to become fibroblasts. So one example is when you have a retrocorneal membrane after injury or trauma. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you get those retrocorneal membranes. Some people think some of those membranes come from proliferation of endothelial cells, and they proliferate, but they lose their properties. They are not nice. They don't pump fluid anymore. They become like fibroblasts. So there's issues there when you do any of these procedures with cells, cell transplant or cell therapy, they can become fibroblastic and then create membranes in the cornea, still having a nice function as a pumping. Still having a pumping mechanism. Right. But who knows? I mean, things are going. I mean, DMEC, I still cannot believe DMEC, how beautiful and how perfect that surgery is. And if you can do it efficiently, Dr. Goroboy, I have one of our fellows used to work with him. 10 minutes, one DMEC, just a couple drops of tetracaine, no stitches. It's amazing.
Right. Now let's talk about more surgical topics here, about making corneal incisions. So we know the cornea changes with age. We know if you make an incision in a young child, the cornea is too elastic. It's not going to seal as well. Whereas if you make it the same incision in a much older patient, a 70, 80-year-old, the cornea is stiffer and it seals much better. How do we judge when we're making our incision? If you're a young surgeon, you're a resident, And then the resident says, Dr. Espana, teach me, how do I judge the tissue to make a really great self-sealing incision? Do I have to take into account any of the corneal stiffness or architecture or the feel of it?
Well, I think, I really think that you have a lot more, the keratinocytes, they are there and they continuously, slowly, they make more and more collagen. So when you age slowly, your cornea gets stiffer. PKP in children or using tissue, you know, the people like, oh, I want to use a cornea from my 8-year-old donor or something. That's so hard to suture. Mm-hmm. And it's just because the cells itself, they keep building more and more tissue, making more matrix, plus there's more natural cross-linking going on and all that stuff is happening. So I don't know. We don't do that many cataract surgeries or surgeries in children, but when we suture in children, just they leak more. That's the way it is. I mean, I don't think there's anything we can do. They just leak a lot. I mean, people in 15, 20, 18 years old, they still leak a lot. Right. And it's a big laceration. Many, many times we have to suture and then put some glue or something like that because they will leak. But I think it's just because that's the way it is. There's still not enough cross-linking and still the cells haven't built that much of a matrix. When we get older, we keep, you know, the cells, they keep making a little bit of collagen and extracellular matrix with time. So it becomes like that. And there's special cases too with, you know, the myopes of patients that have RKs because they were myopes before. The surgeries are complicated. You're so glad you didn't go through one of those cuts and then the wounds leak or something happens in there. So, I got to put stitches all over. I mean, just that's the way it is. Right. Biology, I guess, and nature.
Right, for sure. I do a lot of radial keratotomy patients for cataract surgery. Yeah. Sometimes 100, 200 in a year. Sometimes it's a lot. And so one of my things is, first, I never, ever intersect the RK incisions. So if they have 12 or more RK cuts, I'm going to make a scleral tunnel. I'm always going to suture my scleral tunnel. And then I'm at the end of the case, I will put a fluorescein strip and check all the RK cuts with a dye leak test just to be sure nothing's leaking because you never know.
Never know. Yeah, because the tissue is bad. It's not you. It's nothing. It's just the tissue is too bad. I mean, the collagen is bad. I would say the collagen is bad.
Right.
Yeah, I have had patients with residents doing RKs that have been a problem. Sometimes has been you see there's only four cuts and you think the blade's going to go and then suddenly intersects and then becomes a problem. Then you don't see it, but then when you're doing the removing viscoelastic or something, then suddenly you see the fluid coming out. Whatever. And sometimes it's not just putting one or two or three stitches. It's hard to close up because those intersections are very hard to suture.
For sure. Absolutely. Because people don't realize sometimes, because I've never done radial keratotomy. So the young surgeons have certainly never done it. Those cuts that were done 30 years ago are at least 90%.
90%. Yeah, 90%. So I think there were some surgeons that even if they leak a little bit, they thought it was even better.
Right. They wanted a micro perforation. That's how deep the cuts are. Yeah.
And so, we have seen a couple cases of bad infections in there, either bacterial or mycobacterial in those deep cuts. And then when they end up having a perforation, we do the histology sections and that stuff. You can see they go all the way down. And the epithelium is all the way down there too. So you have almost no stroma left in some of those cases. Almost. Yeah.
Got to be very, very.
And then some surgeons used to do the RKs, and then, I don't know, LRIs, arcoids, whatever you call those, astigmatism. So it was just crazy. I mean, you have no space. You have to go scleral tunnel, as you said.
Yeah. And it's the better option. Don't touch the cornea. Do the scleral tunnel instead.
No, I have done a few cases. There was case when I just got here, maybe, I don't know, 2 years after I was in practice here, and a famous cataract surgeon went through, he was trying to go through between two cuts, and I end up that night putting a little corneal patch because he put a lot of stitches, still couldn't close it, sent it to the hospital, and then I tried to put more stitches now. I had to put a little patch graft in there. We couldn't close it. It's impressive. All right. There was a surgeon in Tampa many, many years ago who did, I don't know, there's 20 cuts sometimes. It was just, you couldn't, I mean, there's so many cuts. I don't know how they did that. I mean, those corneas were very unstable. And sometimes we still get some of those patients that somebody tries to do cataract surgery and they think they can do it through the limbus or a little bit posterior to the limbus, and then there we go. That's a big problem.
Right. Yeah, I agree. No limbus at all. Scleral tunnel is the right way. Don't. Scleral tunnel. Yeah. And then even just the infusion pressure of the phaco can cause those incisions to swell and sometimes even leak. That's why you always have to check for sure.
I don't know if you have seen, but you are in this microscope and the water, the VSS comes to the macros, to the mirror, to the glass of the microscope, the lens of the microscope, leak up.
Yeah.
It's like you found oil in there.
For sure. Now, I saw a patient recently for me coming to me for surgery. And when I saw the patient, I thought, this patient should rather go to you instead. And here's why. The patient I saw had a very dense cataract, had pseudo exfoliation, but also pseudo exfoliation glaucoma, and had Fuchs dystrophy. And so I was just like, wow. Fuchs dystrophy with a corneal bathymetry less than, let's say, less than 1,000, maybe 850. And also, bathymetry of 650 microns, endothelial cell count of less than 1,000 cells per square millimeter. So I just thought, three things at once, dense cataract, pseudo exfoliation glaucoma, and Fuchs dystrophy, can I send the patient to you instead?
Well, I think in that case, maybe I would be more worried about the pseudo exfoliation than anything else, because the rest, as you said, DMX is fantastic, so you know we can fix that. But the pseudo exfoliation is tricky. Those you don't know what you're gonna find. They may look bad, and then you go in, it's not that bad. But sometimes you go there and you don't even touch that eye, and that lens is moving all over. So those are scary. Those cases are complicated. Unfortunately, I have here Dr. Ayala. He loves those pseudo exfoliation cases.
So how would you approach this case? Would you first do the phaco, or maybe phaco plus MIGS? Then let it heal up, then come back and then do a DMEC. What order would you do?
Oh, I think I will do the phaco first. And I'm not a big fan of MIGS. I don't have much experience with MIGS. Because they really need good pressure control. And I also don't want, if I need to do a DMEC later, I don't want to have anything in the mesh where that can do weird things. So I would probably do the cataract. I don't know, you can put if you don't drop it, you can put your capsular tension ring to help, whatever it is. And then I will wait and see later on, come back and probably if the corneal thickness is that thick, I think patient will benefit from a DMEC.
So I like your idea, staged approach. So do the cataract first. Approach. Hopefully it'll be stable and you'll have good secure IOL placement in the bag.
Yeah.
Wait 3 months, let it heal up. Then if you need to go back, you will need to in this case, to go back and do a DMEC.
Yeah, that's the best. We like that way. Sometimes we have done, I've been doing a good number of fakic DMECs, which is like the opposite, because many times these patients that have Fuchs, they have, the corneas are weird. They are like irregular astigmatism, and you don't know it's because they really have irregular astigmatism or because the cornea has been swollen for a while. It's starting to form some subepithelial scar. And so we do the DMEC, fake DMEC, and then we wait. And later on, we go back and do the cataract. And that's been very helpful because the case changed significantly sometimes.
Right.
Significantly. But these cases with exfoliation, that's a different animal. Those you don't know what's going to happen in there.
Yeah, I've realized that two things that I've kind of figured out. I learned from Alan Crandall, the late professor from Utah, who was brilliant, who said that the two big danger signs for him was if the patient has a shallow AC at the slit lamp, but a normal axial length, so 24 millimeter axial length, but then the AC depth is 2 millimeters. He says that patient in the exam chair, lie them back so they're supine, and now look, is the AC deep? And if it is, he says that's a very bad sign because it means the whole lens iris diaphragm is so mobile.
Yeah. And then it's a problem. Then you cannot do your DMEC. I mean, if you have to leave that patient in fake kick or do something, then it's difficult. Vitrectomize or something. Those DMECs on. Then you got to go back to dissect. Those are different. Yeah, those are different.
Right. And then if you're going to do that, you better plan for the eye weld to make the patient a little myopic. Because if it's so complicated, right? So many factors.
No, but I think it's not the Fuchs. It's the big cataract. It's the pseudo exfoliation the problem.
Right. No, no, for sure. I think that's the bigger problem because, as you said, that doing a DMEC or even doing a DSEC is not that difficult. But when you get a case with terrible zonulopathy, that becomes a challenge.
That's a challenge. I mean, I don't know. I personally, when I'm doing a case I haven't done thousands of those, but I have done a good number of those, and things sometimes it's so bad you have to stop. I mean, there's nothing you can do. You just get out of the eye and close the eye, and retina has to come and fix them because it becomes the whole bit just comes forward. It's complicated.
Right. Right.
The dialysis can be pretty bad sometimes.
Right. It sometimes is hard to predict. Sometimes you don't realize how bad the zonulopathy is until you actually go inside the eye.
I have in my practice, I'm the one that speaks Spanish here in the practice. And so all these nice ladies from Colombia, Puerto Rico, Venezuela, Mexico, wherever, they want to see Dr. Spanish because he speaks Spanish. Because, these ladies and some of these people, they have been in this country 2 years, so they haven't seen a doctor for years. So they come with 20, 80 cataracts, 20, 70 cataracts. Those are huge cataracts. And when you find these Hispanic ladies, all ladies, they have like short eyes, and those once in a while you find these cases, as you said, they have zonular issues, and it's not fun. You know you're gonna have trouble, so whatever. What can you do? You just have to go and be prepared to have chest pain.
Yes, Richard, you give it your best and go in a stepwise, like one step at a time, and just see what happens. You gotta just take it one at a time.
One at a time. Well, the nice thing with big cornea specialists is, for me, for example, when I phaco or I'm teaching the residents or the fellows, I tell them, just bring the phaco more anterior. I don't care. If something happens, we will fix it. Don't break the capsule. Just bring it more anterior. It's hard to damage the cornea unless you really go through the decimate pretty much, but it will heal. But just stay away from the posterior capsule as much as you can. Bring it anterior, in the center and anterior to the pupil.
I think you're right. I do the same thing because the posterior capsule is 4 microns and you never fix it. If it breaks, it's done.
Yeah, you're done. I mean, that's it. You cannot do an DMEC after the capsule is ruptured. Or you can.
Right.
It's complicated.
Right. Now you're going to do a DSEC instead. And now you should have put it in the
higher power. DSEC, the ultra thin DSEC is pretty decent too, but it's not the same.
Right. Now, we've been finishing up here. Let's talk about, you have a neat thing because you have clinician and surgeon, but you're also quite deep into the science and the research. So you have both. Whereas for me, I don't do any basic science research. I don't have any mice models. I don't do any of this. I'm very much on the surgical side, clinical side. So you spent thousands of hours in the lab, thousands of hours in the operating room. What do you think are the most important things you've learned in the last 20, 30 years that you can offer to the young ophthalmologists?
Well, I that's one of my, plus I, Dr. Ayala also has me doing committees, a committee for whatever, go to the surgical committee, whatever, do these associate program director fellowship, all these things that we have to do in academics, that takes a lot of time. But to answer your question, one of my goals is, when I came, I was with Schaefer Seng, I was with Jean-Marie Parel, who invented the vitrectomy at Bascom Palmer. I was in Cleveland Clinic with Steve Wilson, Ron Kruger. Who else was in Cleveland? BJ Dupes. All these are clinician scientists. I did glaucoma with a doctor that he's retired now. His name was Robert Rich. He was very inspiring. He's a glaucoma doctor, a New York engineer. All these people always had in their mind that it's important to know these basics and the and to bring something different to, I'm not saying academic, but innovation, or to move forward a little bit in the field. And I think this is the new generations need to learn that, because I think these guys, they only, it's not like they're going to come for 3 years and go and find a job. I think it's important they learn that we can move the field forward. And one of the ways to do it, I think one of the most important ways to do it is with innovation and research, because still, I think, if we can find cures for in the cornea, for example, to do some cell therapy to get some cells there that build the stroma and then stop the keratoconus, makes the cornea thicker or inhibits fibrosis and improves scars. Anywhere you see, or glaucoma, or somewhere. That's my goal. I always try to let residents know that they we are doctors, but at the same time, it used to be that many doctors were Nobel Prize in medicine and stuff like that. We're losing that. We're moving more on to be like, you know, a doctor that does stuff, see patients, but we're losing that part of innovation and research in the, by physicians. I think that's very, very important. But I try to push, and that's something I try to teach residents all the time, or fellows. It's becoming harder and harder. It's becoming harder and harder.
I think that's a great point. For the young ophthalmologist, always ask, why? Why are we doing this way? Why does this happen? Stay curious. Figure out what we do better.
Stay curious. When you see a cornea in the slit lamp, yeah, it's clear, it's everything. But if you look deeper and deeper, you will see there are cells, there's millions of cells, there's epithelial cells, keratinocytes, immune cells going through, the nerves are there. So many things are going there. And something happens in there, things won't work. So, you know, stay curious and keep learning. I like keep learning. I write grants for NIH. And it's a lot of work, but every time I write one of those, I have to read a lot of basic science. I got to read wound healing on the skin. I read a lot about collagens and extracellular matrix in cancer. So it's weird. I have to read that because I'm a cornea doctor and I'm doing other stuff, but I read that. And so I'm doing surgery, complicated cataract in the hospital, Tampa General in the hospital, and I'm doing transplant, but I get home and I'm reading a paper on one of those Nature papers on immune cells in the strain in collagens and stuff like that. But I like it. That's the way my life has become in the last 15 years. And that's the way I am now. So it's that's the way it is. Cannot change that.
That's beautiful. Well, stay curious and always keep learning.
Keep learning. That's otherwise this one dies. Brain dies.
You're right. Again, I want to thank you so much. We've been talking for almost 1 hour now. I can't even believe it. So thank you for the podcast.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I had fun. It was a good time.
Thank you so much. I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new podcast every Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you get a podcast, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. And of course, we have a new Cataract Coach video every single day, almost 2,900 videos and counting. So until next time, I'll catch you later.